Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
It's the number one question I get asked every single day. It's, when are you going to get pregnant? Why aren't you pregnant? Why aren't you having more babies? You know, don't you want that for Shai? There's a lot of that, you know, and there was one comment in particular, like, how could you not? You know, and the how could you not threw me off a ledge. I was like, if only you knew what was actually going on with my family, you would never say that.
So if anyone watches Dancing with the Stars, you recognize that voice. Peta Murgatroyd, who is a famous ballroom dancer. She married another famous ballroom dancer, Max Schmirkovsky. And the two of them have a little boy together. And in the last 2 years, Peta revealed on GMA that she has had three miscarriages. Three miscarriages, a perfectly healthy, even probably well above average from a healthy person. And yet she struggles to get pregnant. And those questions that are asked of her seem to be very common questions asked of most women these days who have zero or only one child. So this morning, I wanted to have Dr. Andrew Levi back on the show and talk a little bit about these trends, what's going on. And I'm very excited to have Dr. Levi here, a good friend of mine from Park Avenue Fertility in Trumbull, Connecticut. Thanks, Dr. Levi, for being here. How are you?
I'm great, Melissa. Thanks for having me on this morning. I appreciate it.
So is that a common trend that we're seeing with most women? And if so, why is that? Why is it harder to get pregnant today than it was even like 30 years ago?
Yeah, you know, it is so common. I think part of it is the awareness, which is, I'll call it a good thing, because the fact that we're having this dialogue today and talking about it is really important. I think part of the reason why we're recognizing it more is because some people didn't even realize they were pregnant. I mean, there was one time where Peta didn't even know she was pregnant. I think it was her third time. She mm-hmm. showed up in the emergency room or what have you, and she didn't even know she was pregnant. So I think awareness is a big part of it, number one. Number two, I think things have changed. I think that one thing we're seeing for sure is, sadly, miscarriage is more common as women get older. And she's 35 years old, and you'll see that a little bit. The prevalence will increase somewhat. And there may be other reasons why, maybe more environmental, that we're seeing these days too, but it is really common. And the most important thing is that those people who are experiencing miscarriage are not alone. This is not an uncommon thing at all.
So would you say, Dr. Levi, that there really hasn't been, other than, like you said, environmental is one thing. I think we've always heard that once you get to your mid-30s, you have a higher risk of miscarriage or unhealthy children. But, I mean, that was the same even when my mom was having kids 35 years ago, was, you know, you should start having kids earlier in life. And like you said, miscarriages weren't something you bragged about. I don't think me and my siblings, we knew my mom had miscarriages, but the general public did not know that. Now she's very open about it now, you know, that she's a grandmother and she's gotten her life, you know, everything she's wanted in life. But that wasn't really something that was talked about 30 years ago. So is there really just not much of a change? It's just it wasn't spoken about.
I think that's a big part of it, to be honest with you, is that when I meet new patients who've experienced miscarriage or have issues getting pregnant, and I take their history and they speak of their family, they speak of their mother, you'd be surprised. Yeah, my mother had multiple miscarriages. She had two miscarriages between my brother and my sister. I think detection is part of it. And I think, honestly, that what you're seeing now, too, is maybe way back when people were just told, oh, just try again, just try again, just try again. Women are being told that now as well, which is a mistake. And I think what we're seeing now is couples, women are being much more proactive. They're not accepting, what do you mean I'm just going to try again? What can I do? What are the things that could be causing this? Who can I see that can be helpful?
And that's where people like Dr. Levi comes in, because you have a fertility clinic. What are some of the things that you do? If you have a woman who, and I know that you do lengthy tests, Dr. Levi, you do a lot of tests on both the women and the men in these marriages or in these unions. And when you deem that they've got, you know, they've got a good bill of health, what's the next step? What can you do when it seems like, okay, there's really nothing getting in your way? We're just kind of down on our luck or something. Like, what are some of the things that you recommend for women?
Yeah, I think your point's well taken, that the most important thing to do is see if there is an issue, which is uncommon. I'll be forthright with you that maybe a third of the time we find something, the other two-thirds of the time we say, well, listen, you know, everything looks good in terms of this evaluation, and it may be for a couple of different reasons. We know that the most common scenario is that most women, when they get pregnant again after experienced miscarriage, will stay pregnant and they'll be okay. But that isn't always the case. So part of our role is to inspire confidence if they're going to try again, which isn't always good enough. What you're seeing now more and more is that we realize that the reason why this woman is having miscarriages is related to the quality or quantity of her eggs. It is not uncommon to see women moving ahead with something like in vitro fertilization to test the fertilized egg to be certain that there are no chromosomal problems with that fertilized egg. And I think that's what's transpiring now with PETA and her husband. I believe, based on what I've read, that they are moving ahead with IVF, and that's probably what they're doing. So it's not the answer for all patients, but in cases of, quote, unexplained miscarriage, where we're not really sure why it is, and it may be something at the level of the egg, IVF may be an answer.
Chatting this morning with Dr. Andrew Levi, who is with Park Avenue Fertility, and we're talking about women and getting pregnant. I think there is, as Dr. Levi had said earlier in the show, I think there's a misconception a little bit with how easy it is to get pregnant. And that's just really not the case for many different reasons. And Dr. Levi, the thing I wanted to ask you is I find very similar to PETA. I fall in PETA's category. Okay. With Chase, it really was very easy. We, in fact, were not even really trying. And here we are with Chase. Beautiful, wonderful little boy. But I find that a lot of my friends, a lot of women who I speak to who had no problem with number one, struggle for years with number two to get number two. And I'm curious why that happens. Like, how is it that the same body that in an instant, it feels like, can get pregnant, really struggles for 2, 3, 5 years to the point that they now need to use intervention in order to get pregnant? How does that happen?
And I would say that in terms of people trying to get pregnant who we see, maybe 20-30% already have a child. The people who have experienced miscarriage, maybe half of them already have a child. And the answer isn't always a, quote, great one. And the answer is that either that something has changed or people were very fortunate the first time. And it's often one or the other, which, you know, isn't a great answer for people because people often say, but I'm so healthy. It's the most common thing I hear is, but I'm so healthy. And this is beyond that. This is a microscopic issue that is really very difficult for patients to control. And that's why it's really important they be their own advocates. They see people who specialize in fertility and reproductive medicine to get the help they need, because there's only so much you can do at home, and people are struggling and they really need to get the appropriate assistance.
So you just kind of hinted at my next question, which is a lot of people believe if they are in optimal health, they work out, they eat well, they're skinny, you know, they got everything. They are like the prime picture. You look great. You are perfect. You know, those are, you know, like you look at a PETA. If no one's familiar with who I'm talking about, literally just look up PETA. And I'm not talking about the animal advocates. I'm talking about PETA Murgatroyd, who is a famous ballroom dancer. She is stunning. I mean, this woman is teeny tiny, you know, amazing shape, very healthy. She is what doctors would say is like beyond the ideal. And she's going through this. And you're right, Dr. Levi, that most people say, but I'm doing everything right. I'm doing everything right. So what's going on? So health really doesn't necessarily play the entire role in getting pregnant, it sounds like.
Yeah, don't get me wrong, that you'll often hear me say things like control what you can control. So I think it's really important to control your mind, control your body. And again, be moderate with those things. There's alcohol. We don't want people smoking, obviously, and having a lean body weight is and being normal weight is very, very important. There's no question about that. But the things that are transpiring here are often, those things are going to help. but they're not going to, if someone has a certain issue that's causing miscarriage, maybe it's an antibody issue, or maybe it's a genetic issue or a chromosomal issue, or maybe it's something at the level of the egg, these things are probably not going to tilt the scales in those scenarios. And the opposite is true, too. I don't want people to think that, oh, my gosh, you know, I'm overweight and that's why I'm miscarrying. That's not the case at all. So there's a difference here in terms of optimizing your health versus saying, you know what, that's not going to tilt the scales, because the issue going on here is not related to how healthy I am. It's something medical. It's something scientific. It's something microscopic. And that's why it's important to see the right person when those things are transpiring.
I can't remember, Dr. Levi, if I had read this somewhere or I heard it from somebody. So I'd rather just ask you, because you'll give me the facts. It has the window, I'm going to call it the window of opportunity. Has that lessened over the years? Like, as a kid, I thought it was like, other than maybe a couple weeks a month, women were pretty much like open to getting pregnant. But now it seems like there's this like window of like maybe a couple of days a month that you're like, hey, you better hit it or you're done. Is that the case? Is that true? Is that false? What truth can you bring to that?
Yeah, the window really hasn't changed.
Okay.
If you look at when people have intercourse, sperm lives inside a woman probably 3 to 7 days. And that really hasn't changed. But what maybe has changed is the male partner. That, yeah, we're certainly seeing more cases of male infertility than we did in the past.
Interesting. Why?
So perhaps that window isn't as vast as we thought it was, because if the male partner, which up to half of the time is kind of figuring into why people aren't getting pregnant, that certainly can be affecting the window. So I think there's a lot of variables that figure into this that is causing the change that you're referring to.
Why are we seeing more infertile men? Why is that happening?
Yeah, you know, it's, I do believe that's environmental. You know, there are studies done years and years and years ago that women who were pregnant in the 60s, 70s with men, for instance, all right, with boys, if they ate a lot of meat that had been fortified with testosterone and hormones, their sons were more likely to have lower sperm counts. There's data out there that having your cell phone in your front pocket and having a laptop with Wi-Fi in your lap can affect sperm counts. There's more and more men who are doing anabolic steroids or are on testosterone or on medication. So I think there's a lot of things that figure into that. I think as the world is changing, it's affecting fertility for the good and the not so good too.
Interesting. And I know I have a quick question, because we were talking about IVF before, Dr. Levi, and I think I know the answer to this, but blood work. I think when you go into doing IVF or any of these things, do both the husband and wife get extensive lab work done to check for things like clotting disorders or just anything that you could find within the process?
Yeah, it really depends on the diagnosis, but you're right that when people are experiencing miscarriage, we will evaluate both the male and the female. Males are really looked at just for chromosomal issues in terms of how their genetic material is arranged. Women are tested for other things, mostly antibodies that can cause clotting at the microscopic level that can lead to miscarriage. When it comes to actually IVF and getting pregnant and the like, The male testing really is just looking at their semen analyses and looking at the sperm counts. The women are having, of course, more diagnostic testing, looking at ovarian function, looking at their hormone levels, looking at the anatomy. So in this case here, the women are going to have more exhaustive testing, for lack of better words. But the key is to be really comprehensive here.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Levi, if people want to contact your office, they want a consultation, how do they contact you?
Yeah, they, there's two different ways probably to reach us. The website, which is www.parkatfertility.com, is always a great way. And there's a link there and a portal there where people can request appointments. And they can reach us by phone as well. We're at 203-372-6700. So either way, and we do a pretty good job of, you know, often there's long waits there. We do our best to get people in because we recognize this is such an important thing. And waiting is part of the problem as well. So we're pretty good about getting people in right away.
Dr. Levi, I really appreciate you. Thank you for all that you do, and thanks for coming on this morning.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Dr. Levi with Park Avenue Fertility right here in Trumbull, Connecticut on WICC. Joining me now is Dr. Michael Redler with the Connecticut Orthopedic Institute. And good morning to you, Dr. Redler. So glad you're here. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Glad to be with you.
So, I don't know, Dr. Redler, are you a golfer?
I am a golfer. I belong and play at Brooklawn Country Club in Fairfield, which hosted last year's U.S. Women's Senior Open.
Yes.
And I enjoy it for the camaraderie, the exercise, and the challenge.
Okay. So you have every right, because of your profession and because you like to play golf, to kind of throw out some tips and tricks for what we should do to make sure we're protecting ourselves. People who have never played golf before probably think you can't get hurt in golf. It's very simple. It's very slow. But that could not be further from the truth. It's actually very easy to hurt yourself in golf. It may not be like hockey or football, but there are a lot of tweaks and pains that people will go through if they're not properly taking care of themselves. So, first of all, what are some of the more common golf-related injuries people will go through?
Well, Melissa, as you suggest, you know, golf is not a collision sport. Nevertheless, it is one that requires endurance, flexibility, and strength. You know, and so some of the injuries that we see very commonly in golfers are back pain. And we know that, you know, 75% to 85% of Americans will get some sort of golf pain or back pain during their lifetime. The twisting motion of golf, the repetitive nature can certainly cause it there as well. We will all see a lot of injuries of the elbow. There's something called golfer's elbow that involves inflammation and overuse. You're walking the course, you're twisting, you're bending. So knee pain is very, very common. And then we see a lot of shoulder, wrist, and hand injuries just from the actual motion of swinging. So we can see a lot of injuries with golf. Some of them are overuse, and some of them are just from one acute injury that is caused by a bad swing, bad lie when you're on the course, or a root on the ground. So a lot of things can occur that really can injure the golfer and keep them from being able to enjoy the game.
And honestly, it sounds like, Dr. Redler, you know, sometimes when you talk about back pain, people think, oh, that comes with age. But some of the things you just mentioned, I mean, even a teenage golfer who's on their high school golf team could have that happen to them.
So what we know is that as you swing a golf club, you're doing a torsion type motion. You've got to have a stable pelvis. You've got to have strong core muscles. But if you're exceeding your flexibility in terms of your back, that repetitive motion can cause back pain for certain.
Yeah, exactly. Dr. Redler is here, and he's with the Connecticut Orthopedic Institute through St. Vincent's Medical Center, and we're talking about golf injuries. So how do you prevent these kinds of injuries, Dr. Redler?
Well, Melissa, that's a great question, because there's a lot you can do before you get out on the course that can make the game more enjoyable and more pain-free. We know that, listen, golf is an endurance sport. If you walk the course, you probably walk 6 miles. So you want to build up just basic endurance so that you can actually do so. Even if you're riding a cart and getting in and out, there's still some endurance because of the repetitive nature of the game. That's important. Flexibility is so important. And we know at different ages, our level of flexibility can vary. And working on a stretching program for your back, for your hamstrings, for your shoulders, even for your wrists and your hands is going to be so important. And when you're on the course, don't exceed that flexibility. You know, we see some golfers out there that want to try and swing like some of the pros will be playing up in Cromwell this week, but their body mechanics and their flexibility won't allow them. So swinging within your level of flexibility is important. We know that gentle strengthening for the muscles in the legs is going to be important, for the shoulders, and even for grip strengthening is going to be important. So doing some things that occur before you get out on the course will make that time on the course also more enjoyable.
So did I hear you correctly? If you walk the course, it's about 6 miles worth of walking?
It is. And, you know, you can have one of your little Fitbits or your iWatch on there or something. And, you get a lot of steps in there. So, and you're out there, you're seeing beautiful nature. Sometimes you're seeing some things you don't want to see, like sand traps or roughs. But nevertheless, you're getting a lot of exercise in there. And it's a great way to spend some time together.
Wow. First of all, I just gained so much more respect for caddies who have to carry all that stuff while walking the 6 miles. That's crazy. And then the other thing that I just thought of is my father, who was he had been accepted to Division I down in Florida for golf a zillion years ago. And he quit his freshman year. And forever we were like, Dad, why did you quit? Like, you're such an incredible golfer. Like, why would you quit? You were in D1. And he's like, They had us trained to run. Like, they had us run like a couple miles a day, and I didn't want to run. So, and we always couldn't figure out why they made him run. We were like, you know, your endurance was fine, like you were in healthy condition, but it's got to be because you had to walk the 6 miles. That's crazy. I never knew it was that much. Wow. It's a lot.
Well, you know, I think that what we know with an awful lot of sports, endurance is so important.
It is, yeah.
And it may not be the first mile, the first number of holes, but your ability to be able to still be focused, to be able to concentrate on the shot, and to not be absolutely exhausted by the time you get to that back nine is going to be important. And that's why the endurance is so important. Matter of fact, I tell my athletes, and I always wanted to trademark this saying, is that real life is an endurance sport. Mm. So being able to build up and being able to go through that whole process is going to be important. It takes a little training and planning ahead of time.
So do you have patients, Dr. Redler, who you recommend use carts instead of walking the greens?
So we know if someone's got significant arthritis in their knees, if they've got some issues with their heart or just with their ability to walk that distance, then a cart may be more ideal. I think being out there and being able to play in a cart is way better than not being able to play at all.
Yeah.
There are some courses, frankly, that based on their design and their layout are less likely to be good candidates for walking the course.
Mm.
I think that whenever you can, walking is a great way to get some exercise and to play the game. But the game for many of us is so fun, often, not mm-hmm. always, that
yes.
if the cart is necessary, then by all means do that so that you can get out and participate.
Mm-hmm. Yes, my husband will often tell me that. Oh, today was an okay day. And I think to myself, you had a beautiful day. You were outside. It was 72 degrees. You took the half a day off from work. How could it not be a great day? Well, it was a good day of golf. So I've heard that saying enough times. And I am curious, Dr. Redler, are there certain signs you should be looking for, like a pinch in your back or any kind of a sting or a pain? Like, are there things you could pick up on as a golfer before things exacerbate and get worse?
Well, you know, listen, I think that's a great question. And I think when we're out on the course, and like many sports, you tend to ignore those little things.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start feeling some tightness in the back, if you start feeling the muscles become really, really tight and spasm in the back, pay attention to it. If you start getting elbow pain after you played and it doesn't go away and you can't attribute it to just post-exercise muscle soreness, then those are things that you should certainly seek care. You know, a little bit of preventative medicine with a home program, a physical therapy program, can go a long way in terms of keeping you healthy. You know, we've got some great sports medicine specialists at Connecticut Orthopedic Institute and at Connecticut Orthopedics that can help guide you to keep minor injuries minor.
Dr. Michael Redler, a great information from the Connecticut Orthopedic Institute at St. Vincent's Medical Center. If you want to learn more or connect with them, head over to ctorthostvincents.org. Again, ctorthostvincents.org. And Dr. Redler, it was so good to connect with you. Thank you so much. I hope you have a great golf season.
Melissa, I appreciate it. You know, and golf is one of those metaphors of life. When you finish, you only remember the really good shots.
I love that. Dr. Redler, look at you, a poet and a doctor, all wrapped in one. Very, very cool. Dr. Redler, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Melissa, thanks for having me.
All right.
Have a great day.
Talk to you soon. Yes, of course, that's Dr. Michael Redler here on WICC.
It's time to get up and get moving. Workout Wednesday. Melissa in the morning on WICC 600.
So I know technically yesterday was the big yoga day, was International Yoga Day, but I think it's worth having the conversation about the benefits of yoga and really just stretching in general. So that's what we're focusing on this morning for Workout Wednesday. Our wellness coach, Amy Linus, is here. Good morning, Amy. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much for asking. So
yeah.
I'm going to confess something to you, and I really hope this doesn't impact our friendship.
Let's hear it.
Okay. I hate stretching. I never used to stretch until I got pregnant with Chase. I never stretched after any workouts. That is a true statement. The only time I did was when I had dance practice. Like, they make you stretch. You have to stretch.
Yeah.
It's not even the idea of feeling good. Like, stretching feels amazing. It's that it takes 10 to 15 minutes, and I'm in a go, go, go kind of a mood all the time. that stretching always felt like it was such a waste of time. And it wasn't until, like I said, 3-4 years ago that I actually started to appreciate stretching. So talk to people, help them to not be like me and to incorporate stretching in more frequently in their lives.
Oh, yes. Whenever those muscles are nice and warm at like the end of a workout, it is amazing for you to stretch and cool down because you develop a deeper mind to muscle connection and control. And you also open your muscle bellies up and allow for more growth, more strength, and more capabilities just throughout your normal workouts. I mean, it's so amazing for you to do that. And, you know, when we're training and we're forcing blood flow into those muscles, we're getting them nice and bound and tight. And you don't want to walk around in pain or having, you know, your piriformis muscles are a perfect example. They're kind of in your lower back area. And when those get really tight, they can pull on your lower spine, causing a lot of lower back pain. So if you work on stretching those out and keeping those pliable, right off the bat, just from stretching those areas alone, you're going to have a lot less tension and tightness and soreness in that lower back. Just to give you an example.
Yeah. So talk to the idea of like specifically even, you know, yoga. Why is yoga so successful? I mean, people rave about it. They love it.
It is. And it's not just like a kumbaya thing. It's actually good for your mind, body, and spirit because it helps to teach us how to calm our brains down and how to breathe deeply and how to really focus on internally, like calming ourselves down. Because, I mean, think about how the world is. And, you know, you're out in Connecticut, New England area, where I'm in New York, and it's like go, 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 nonstop, nonstop, nonstop all the time. And if you don't practice on calming things down, you can really stress yourself out. So it's great for reducing stress, anxiety, and also helps improve sleep.
That's amazing. So if you're somebody who is just not into stretching, is there a way to kind of ease people into it?
Yeah, there is. You can definitely take classes. Pilates is a great way to start. Also, taking a basic beginner yoga class, too, is a great way to start. Or start with, you know, something that's about 10 to 15 minutes so that you're not saddling yourself for the full-blown hour. Because most people look at that and they're like, it's an hour. Yes, it is an hour. But it's an hour out of your day, and you have 24 of those. So you have to put things in perspective and really, you know, learn to make certain things part of your day to help benefit yourself. You know, change takes place whenever you make the change. Like, you have to change things. You cannot continuously do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result. So it starts with you guys.
And it's interesting, Amy, because when I see people who are, like, big gym goers, you know, you sort of expect those results. You expect to see people who are chiseled or cut or tone or have muscle. Like, you expect it. I always find it so incredible that most people who do yoga also are pretty toned and are thin and are in great shape. And people will kind of go, I don't get it. You're just stretching. How could you have similar results to people who are in a gym 5 days a week lifting weights?
Well, you're engaging all of your muscles in holding those poses. So essentially, you are lifting weight. You're lifting your own body weight, but you're holding it in those poses. So it's more of a strenuous and endurance type of a workout. But because of that, those muscles become harder and tighter and denser and stronger. So, yeah, they have those longer, lean, slender bodies, but they're super tough, powerful, and strong, just as much as if someone were weightlifting. It's just a different kind of a look and a feel for sure, but very, very similar in a lot of ways.
Amy, if you have any tips or tricks or anything that people should be learning about when it comes to stretching specifically, do you have a website or anything people could go to?
It's fitbodyvibe.com, fitbodyvibe.com. We are on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. So come check us out and connect with us online.
Amy, I always love connecting with you. Thank you so much. Namaste, and I will talk to you soon.
Namaste, my beautiful Melissa. I'll talk to you.
Yeah, sounds good. Amy Linus here on WACC. She is our wellness coach and also our workout guru. She's here each and every Wednesday morning to give us some new tips and tricks to stay healthy and live better lives.